I'm sorry, he said. Why did you leave me? Anyway, I'm checking out a place this afternoon that looks promising. Back to her friendly clone voice. We never yelled at each other, said Logan. And he held his breath, because talking about their relationship was against their unspoken rules of engagement. Come home. Please put your god-awful painting back up on the wall. There was a long pause. We never really argued, said Logan. Did we? Why did you leave? Can you come home now, please? There's no point talking about this now, said Indira. I've got to... Logan spoke fast. On Father's Day, just before Mum collapsed, she was getting really upset about you and me breaking up and Brooke and Grant breaking up. Brooke is well rid of him, said Indira, who had taken against Grant in a way that Logan had never really understood. Logan barreled on. And anyway, she asked if she and Dad had not set a good example to us of a good marriage. Your mum and dad have a great relationship, said Indira. They're so cute together. I'll call your mum today. He could hear pain in her voice. She loved Logan's parents. She'd probably talked more to them in the past 5 years than Logan had. Talking to his parents was like a domestic duty he'd handed over to her because she was so good at it. Like she'd handed over bathroom cleaning to him because he was so good at streak-free shower screens. They do have a great relationship, agreed Logan. Although, it's funny, when you called I was thinking about how my dad used to... He couldn't find the right word for what his dad used to do, and he wasn't sure if he really wanted to talk about it anyway. How your dad used to what? Said Indira, as if she wanted to know. And if this was a way to keep her on the phone and hear her normal voice, then he would take it. He used to do this thing when we were kids, maybe 3 or 4 times a year. Not that often. It wasn't a big deal, except that it was kind of a big deal. I'm sure I told you, he said. You never told me, said Indira. Her voice sounded a little louder in his ear, as if she'd just sat up. And so he sat up straighter too. Oh, said Logan, well, if my dad got angry enough about something, he'd just walk away. You mean he avoided conflict, said Indira. There were certain syllables where he could hear the trace of her long-lost English accent, just on the con in conflict. I guess that's what he was doing, said Logan. It didn't feel like he was avoiding conflict. It felt like a punishment, because you never knew how long it would be before he came back. But I don't quite get it. Where did he go? We never knew. What would happen if he asked now? Where did you go, Dad? What was that all about? So he didn't just leave the room, he left the house? Yeah, said Logan. Once Troy and I were fighting in the back of the car on the way to a tournament, and Dad stopped the car on a 6-lane highway, got out, walked off, and we didn't see him again until the following night. The following night, screeched Indira. It did sound quite strange now that he said it out loud. He remembered how they had all sat in the car watching their father walk away, his pace unhurried, as if he were right on time for an important appointment. The car had felt hot and stuffy and airless. The only sound, the whoosh of passing traffic and the monotonous tick, tick, tick of the indicator that their father had left on when he pulled over. That was the day Brooke got her first migraine, or the first one that Logan remembered anyway, the day their mother said, flatly after 20 minutes, "He's not coming back," and got out of the car and went around to the driver's seat and drove them to the tournament, where Logan lost 6-2, 6-1 against that troll of a kid from the Central Coast with no technique. He didn't remember how the others went in their matches. Dad must have hitched a ride, Logan thought now, for the first time. Obviously, that's what he did. There was no Uber to call back then, no mobile phones. Not that his dad had a mobile phone now. He must have stuck out his thumb, hitched a ride, and spent the night in a cheap hotel. No great mystery. It had all seemed so terrifyingly mysterious when they were children, like he'd vanished into thin air. He thought about ringing up his dad now and saying, "So what? You stayed at a travel lodge? Good on you, big man. Big deal, Dad." "The longest time he was away was 5 nights," said Logan. He'd counted the nights. It was after Troy jumped the net and beat up Harry Haddad, so the whole family was angry with Troy.
5 nights? But your mother must have been in a state," said Indira. "Didn't she call the police?"
"I don't think she ever did," said Logan. He didn't know if she ever called the police or not. He assumed not, because he always came back. She knew he'd come back. He remembered Brooke crying into her spaghetti bolognese while their mother soothed her, as if this were no more serious than running out of Parmesan cheese. "Daddy is coming back, silly girl. Stop making such a fuss. He just needs to clear his head." There were no bitter asides from their mother about their father when he was gone, just reassurances that he would be back, not to worry, he'd be back any minute, and they could forget all about it. You just had to be patient.
"You never asked where he went?" asked Indira.
"You weren't allowed to ask. You had to pretend nothing happened. That was like the rule." "I can't believe your mother put up with this," said Indira. She paused.
"Surely Amy asked where your dad went?"
Logan had a sudden distressing flash of memory. Amy running down the hall and launching herself against their father when he came back one time, pummeling his chest with small fists, screaming, "Where did you go, stupid, bad, naughty daddy? Where did you go?" And their mother pelting along behind her, unpeeling her from Stan, who stood as unresponsive and expressionless as a tree. Was that the time his dad turned around and left again? Or was that another time? "He did it at my 9th birthday party," said Logan, "before we sang happy birthday."
"That's awful," said Indira. "That's really awful. Stan. Lovely Stan. I thought he was just a big old bear."
"Oh, well," said Logan. "It's not the worst thing a man can do, and he wasn't gone for that long that day. He was back in time to put me to bed." That time, his dad had bought him a crunchy bar. He remembered the gold shimmer of the wrapping as his dad put it under the covers next to him. It was the closest he ever got to an apology. And the taste of the illicit chocolate in bed, shared with no sibling, after he'd cleaned his teeth. He knew objectively that his father had behaved badly that day, even cruelly, but still the memory of the crunchy bar shimmered gold in his memory, evidence of his father's love. "At some point, he stopped doing it," said Logan. "I don't remember exactly when. Sometime in my teens, I guess. And we all just forgot about it." "Still, that would have been pretty formative," said Indira. for you.
No, said Logan. He was suddenly profoundly irritated. Indira's parents were both psychologists, and he hated it when she attempted to apply this kind of simplistic cause and effect psychology to him, because she was a graphic designer, so what did she know? And surely her parents were not good psychologists, because if so, you'd think they might have analysed themselves and diagnosed themselves as awful, and maybe they might have noticed that their gorgeous daughter hated her gorgeous body. It wasn't formative. It was just a weird habit my dad had, and he grew out of it. It didn't form me. Did I ever do that to you? Did I ever disappear on you? Indira didn't answer. Indira, you know I didn't. I never did. Something was building in him.
You never physically left, said Indira slowly. But whenever we had any kind of disagreement, you definitely checked out.
I checked out, said Logan. What the hell does that mean?
Now he could hear the echo of his mother, except that his mother would say, what the heck does that mean? He didn't wait for an answer. What did it matter now? Indira was the one who had left, who had checked out without an explanation.
I've got to go, he said.
Yeah, said Indira coolly. I expect you do.
Now, what the hell did that mean? He didn't wait to find out. He hung up and slammed down his phone on the wooden arm of the couch. He sat for a moment, his heart beating fast. He remembered times throughout his relationship with Indira when he'd actually felt the desire to do exactly as his father had done, to stand up and leave the room, to go for a drive around the block to calm himself down over a disagreement, an accusation, an issue that seemed to be upsetting her. And he never once had. It had taken all his self-control to force himself to remain. And as often as not, Indira had been the one to suddenly throw her hands up, to walk away, to slam the door behind her. And now she was acting as if that demonstrated some sort of character flaw. He hadn't yelled like his mother. He hadn't left like his father. He certainly hadn't done anything unforgivable like his grandfather, whose violent actions hung like a shameful pall over their family. As a child, Logan had once found a tiny black and white photo of a man in a fedora and trouser suspenders in the back of a drawer, and when his father caught him studying it, he'd snatched it from his hands as if it were porn. Stan didn't need to say that the man in the fedora was his father. Logan had felt his father's hot shame, and he shared it. He accepted it as part of his heritage, like his height and hair. Whenever there was conflict in his relationships, he took immense care not to repeat the mistakes of the past. He clenched his body tight and waited for those potentially catastrophic feelings to pass, which they eventually did. But there was no recognition or praise or approval for what had cost him so dearly. It doesn't matter how hard you try, you won't ever be good enough. It was true about tennis. It was true about everything. He would always be average, smack bang in the middle of the bell curve on every scale. Good enough to get a girl like Indira, not good enough to keep her. His heartbeat slowed. He was done. He saw it very clearly. He was done with relationships. The relief and absolute correctness of his decision reminded him of when he made the decision to give up competitive tennis. No more striving, no more failing. The absolute bliss of thinking, I will never lose again. He would be a bachelor. His refrigerator would never see another tub of yogurt.
He would have no pictures on his walls, no hat stand, no throw cushions on his bed. He would be fine. He would be better than fine. His phone rang again. He picked it up and saw that the screen had a spider web of cracks across it, as though it had been shot with a miniature bullet. If it was Indira calling back, he would ignore her. But he saw it was the head of his department, so he answered in his professional voice.
"Logan, mate," said Don Travis.
He had a deep, slow voice like Logan's dad, but he was a relaxed Queenslander, and the one word that could never be applied to either of Logan's parents was relaxed.
"Mate, just wondering if you got any problems with, ex-girlfriends at the moment?"
"Ex-girlfriends?" Logan's head snapped back so fast he hurt his neck. "What do you mean? Why?" He looked wildly around his apartment. Was he being bugged? How could Don possibly know about Indira? Logan kept his personal life completely separate from his work. There were no office parties or drinks. There was an annual Christmas party that Logan had never attended.
"We got an anonymous telephone complaint about you."
"What kind of complaint?" Logan was well liked by his students. He never got complaints. He got thank you letters.
"Well, she was kind of implying sexual harassment, although it wasn't really clear exactly what she was implying."
"What the?" Logan got to his feet.
"I know, Logan, I know. Your record is impeccable. That's why I wondered if you might have been through a relationship breakup recently."
"I have just broken up with someone," said Logan, "but she would never, never in a million years."
"You sure, mate? Because sometimes people lose their minds after a breakup."
"I'm 100% sure." He would bet his life on it.
"Well, we explained the process and what she needs to do if she wants to make an official complaint. But she hung up," said Don. "It was a week ago now, and seeing as she didn't give a name or even say which class she'd taken, we're not going to take it any further. I just wanted to give you a heads up that there might be someone out there with some kind of vendetta."
He cleared his throat.
"No need to be embarrassed. I had an ex who gave me a whole world of trouble once, so I sympathise. Or maybe it was just a random crazy. It happens."
Logan thanked him and hung up. He thought about the ex-girlfriends before Indira.
No, no, no. All the way back to Tracy, when Troy was also dating a Tracy. Troy's Tracy might have done something like that, but not Logan's Tracy.
Logan picked good girlfriends. He always got invited to their weddings. Would he one day get a cheerful invitation to Indira's wedding? The thought of watching Indira marry someone else was like imagining the death of a loved one. It must have been a random crazy, as Don had suggested. But still, it was unsettling. This whole day was feeling very unsettling. He picked up his beer and the remote, unmuted the television, and flicked through channels. An episode of Friends, an episode of Seinfeld, an episode of Antiques Roadshow. Everything at this time of day was a rerun. He stopped on a pretty woman with brown curly hair talking to an interviewer. The camera was close on her face as she said pleadingly, "I don't know why they put those shows on television. They don't help. It makes it worse." He must have seen it before. He didn't recognize her, but there was something so familiar about the way her voice skittered up on the word worse. She continued on. Those stories always put him in a filthy mood. I think they made him feel guilty. He'd be like, it's always the man's fault, never the chick's fault.
Logan was standing in his parents' backyard and Savannah was telling the story of her boyfriend hitting her. He was almost positive that some of the words were identical to the words Savannah had used. It's always the man's fault, never the chick's fault. He put down his beer, turned up the volume. The girl said, so I changed the channel super fast. I was like, oh, I want to watch The Bachelor. Not exactly the same story. Didn't Savannah say she changed the channel to some other show? Was it Survivor? It must be a weird coincidence.
I started to relax, said the curly-haired girl. The camera zoomed in on eyes swimming with tears. And then I thought, ah, oh, it's fine. And then, like a stupid idiot, I asked if he'd paid the car registration.
She'd asked if he'd paid the car registration. That's what Savannah had said too. He was absolutely certain that's what she'd said. It had to be more than a coincidence. Surely.
The two domestic violence incidents could be precipitated by a question about car registration? I wasn't trying to make a point. Apparently, I was being passive-aggressive. And then it all just spiraled from there. He broke my jaw. 3 ribs. I was in hospital for longer than he was in jail.
An old photo of the woman filled the screen. It made Logan wince and look away. The girl's face was unrecognizable, like swollen, black bruised fruit. Had Savannah helped herself to someone else's painful story? Something had happened to Savannah. Her injury was real, even if it was minor and hardly compared to the atrocious injuries this poor woman had suffered. He looked back at the television. Another woman in a white coat with a stethoscope around her neck sat behind a desk, talking with despairing expertise about the scourge of domestic violence she had personally witnessed. Logan remembered Savannah's ex-boyfriend sitting up in bed, grabbing for his glasses. Something had felt off. The guy had just seemed so confused. But Logan had sternly chastised himself. His instincts were wrong and evil. How dare he question a woman's story of being abused just because the man didn't look like the type? Logan picked up his phone, scrolled through his contacts, and considered who to call. He didn't want to disturb Brooke at work, and she had enough to worry about at the moment with her separation. He could call Troy, but Troy's first instinct would be to throw money at the problem. Would he offer money to Savannah to make her go away? Maybe it wasn't a bad idea, except that she seemingly made their parents so happy. He would call Amy. He realized he'd always been going to call Amy because in spite of everything, she was still in charge. She was their mad queen, to whom they still all swore their lifelong allegiance.
What's on your mind? Answered Amy in her big sister voice.
Savannah, said Logan.
Oh, me too, said Amy happily. I don't like her at all.
Chapter 27. Now. Apparently, the husband had a habit of walking out the door and disappearing when family life got too much for him, said Christina to her boss. She was in his office giving him an update on the Joy Delaney investigation.
Smart man, said her boss, Detective Sergeant Vince Oates.
He had 4 children under the age of 5. He drank Red Bull like it was water.
Some of the family think this is payback, said Christina. It's the wife's turn to walk out.
What do you reckon?
She's been gone 16 days now. The longest the husband ever left was 5 nights, and that was over 20 years ago.
The last thing we need this year is another nobody homicide case, said Vince morosely. He rattled his empty can of Red Bull.
I know, said Christina. They just had a high-profile case fall apart. Too much media. No result. Dispiriting for all involved.
I really want a body. She paused. I mean, obviously, I don't want a body. If she's dead, you do.
If she's dead, I do, agreed Christina.
If she were a betting woman, she would have put 100 to 1 on Joy Delaney being dead.
Chapter 28. Last October. As soon as Amy got off the phone from Logan, she went downstairs wearing nothing but a T-shirt and bumped straight into Simon Barrington, who should have been at work at this time. The house was meant to be hers during business hours. Her young flatmates all had sensible, young person corporate jobs, which was the way she liked it.
Sorry.
Simon flattened himself dramatically against the wall and averted his eyes, as if they hadn't had sex last weekend. This was the problem with sleeping with your flatmates. It put everything out of rhythm. And with everything going on with her family right now, she wanted things to remain in rhythm.
We had sex last weekend, she reminded him, to put him at ease.
The sex had been vigorous and wholesome, as sweet and delicious as apple crumble. She didn't think she'd ever slept with such a clean man. Even when dishevelled and drunk, he'd smelled of soap and clean laundry. This didn't seem to put him at ease at all. He blushed. He actually blushed. He was a darling.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, he said.
He paused. I mean, I'm not actually sorry about it. He cleared his throat. Should I be sorry about it?
Amy sighed. Why aren't you at work right now, Simon Barrington?
I resigned, he said. I'm making some big life changes.
So you're not going to be an accountant anymore?
He looked taken aback at the thought. Oh, no, I'll still be an accountant, just not for that particular practice. I'm going to take a few months off, clear my head, maybe travel.
A shadow of a frown crossed his face.
Do you like to travel? She asked.
Not much, he said. Anyway,
he took a deep breath and clapped his hands together in an adorably geeky way.
What are you up to?
I'm getting my jeans out of the dryer and then I'm going to visit my parents. There's a strange woman living with them right now. My brother thinks she's up to something.
What? You think she's a scammer? Said Simon.
Well, so far all she's done is cook really excellent food for them, admitted Amy.
But you're trying to work out her end game? Said Simon.
Exactly, said Amy. My parents are extremely innocent.
All parents are innocent, said Simon.
My parents nearly fell for that latest tax office scam. If you can believe it.
Oh, no, said Amy, who had nearly fallen for it herself.
Thankfully, she'd called Troy when she was on the way to the bank to withdraw money to pay her apparently unpaid taxes.
It's a scam, you idiot, he'd shouted from America.
I can give you a lift over to your parents' place, if you like, offered Simon.
You don't drive, do you?
He said this with interest rather than implied criticism. Some people couldn't get over her lack of a driver's license. It was like her dad's refusal to own a mobile phone. People took it personally.
I've never been behind the wheel of a car, said Amy. I'm pretty sure I died in a car accident in a previous life, possibly involving a bridge.
She really did think this. She had fragmented memories of a crash, water, glass, screaming. It may well have been from a movie.
Were you driving?
What?
In your previous life, said Simon. Were you behind the wheel?
Oh, said Amy.
I think so. So you have been behind the wheel of a car, said Simon. Just not in this life.
That's right, said Amy. You're very accurate, aren't you? He had actually been very accurate, even when drunk.
I have good attention to detail, said Simon. I'm thorough.
You are, said Amy, straight-faced. Your attention to detail is scrupulous.
He held her eyes for just long enough to show he got it, and then he said, I could give you my accurate opinion on this potential scammer.
Your accurate accountant's opinion? Said Amy.
That's right, said Simon. I don't have anything else to do right now, and one of my goals for the next few weeks is to improve my spontaneity.
Why? Asked Amy, interested. She had always been advised to pull back on her spontaneity.
You know I was meant to be getting married this April? When my fiancé was explaining why she'd decided to end the relationship, she had a list of, you know, things about me that didn't work for her, and one of them was my lack of spontaneity.
She wrote a list of things that didn't work for her? Asked Amy.
She liked lists, said Simon. It was something we had in common.
She sounds just lovely, said Amy.
You sound like my sister, said Simon.
Amy looked at him. He radiated good health, as if he'd just stepped out of a bracing cold shower after a run. His t-shirt was crisp and clean.
Do you iron your jeans? She asked. He was so exotic.
Of course, he said. Okay, she said. It's okay that I iron my jeans?
No, that is definitely not okay. I mean, okay, you can come with me to meet the scammer, the possible scammer. She may also be a nice girl who is down on her luck. It's up to us to make that call.
I'll keep an open mind.
He looked pleased. I'll just go put my unironed jeans on, she said.
No problem.
He courteously waved his hand to let her pass him on the stairs. She was a head taller than him, so now that she was on the step below him, they were eye to eye. He had bushy old man eyebrows and good, honest, tax-paying eyes.
Before I do that, said Amy. She moved a fraction closer.
Before you do that? Repeated Simon, and there was a catch in his voice. It was like the satisfaction of striking a match first go. She saw the understanding spark and shine in his eyes.
We could work on your spontaneity, she said.
We could, said Simon.
Just very quickly, said Amy.
So they did that.
An hour later, Amy stood at her parents' front door and rang the doorbell that didn't work, just in case it had been fixed, and then, without waiting, because she knew it would never be fixed, knocked hard with her knuckles. She looked at her clean, delicious flatmate standing next to her in his white t-shirt matching his white teeth, with his buzz cut and broad shoulders and glasses, like a door-to-door missionary or the nerdy best friend from a teen vampire movie. Her mother would ask Simon lots of probing questions, and Simon would be the type to answer them in polite, comprehensive detail, and her mother would remember that comprehensive detail for years after Amy had forgotten Simon Barrington's very existence. He was a distraction from the visit's main purpose, which was to subtly collect as much biographical data about Savannah as possible, particularly as it related to the alleged assault. "You brought your flatmate. Why?" She could just hear her sister and brothers, that careful, patient tone they sometimes used, as if she were an explosive device that could detonate at any moment. "Is this where you grew up?" Simon asked, looking about him. "Yes," she said. "Happy childhood?" asked Simon. He looked at the big pots of flowers, the shiny, clean terracotta tiles, and the stone figurines in the carefully tended garden beds. "It looks like the setting for a happy childhood." He touched the tip of his runner to the base of the statue by the front door. It was a blank-eyed little girl in a bonnet holding an empty basket. What happened to her eyes? "The crows took them," said Amy. "She looks like a demon child," commented Simon. "I know," said Amy. "I always think that." Maybe she and the accountant were actually soulmates. The door opened the tiniest crack. A low, husky voice said, "Can I help you?" For a second, Amy wondered if she'd somehow come to the wrong house. Anything was possible. But then the door swung open just to the length of the security chain, and Savannah stood there, wearing not Amy's old clothes, but a long-sleeved paisley shirt tucked into three-quarter-length black pants that Amy was pretty sure belonged to her mother. It was worse seeing Savannah in her mother's cast-offs than in her own. "Oh, hi, Amy," she said. "How are you? Your mum is asleep at the moment?" When Joy collapsed on Father's Day, it had been Savannah who caught her and carefully laid her on the floor. Joy's head had ended up resting on Savannah's lap, and one could hardly say, "Get out of the way, strange girl, that's my mother. Her head should be resting on my lap." "That's okay." Amy had talked to her mother a few times on the phone since she'd got out of hospital, and she knew she'd been napping. "I won't wake her. What's Dad doing?" She waited for Savannah to hurry up and release the security chain. "He fell asleep in front of the television," said Savannah, and she stuck out her lower lip to convey, "Aw, isn't that adorable?" "I think he got a real fright when your mother was in hospital last week, so they both have some catching up to do." "Oh," said Amy. Her father was a veteran snoozer. He always dozed in front of the television. He'd be awake any minute. "Well, I'll still come in and..." "Now is not such a good time," said Savannah. "Now is not such a good time? Did she really just say that?" Amy felt many emotions on a given day. Desire for inappropriate men, nostalgia for long-ago days that never actually happened, great rolling waves of happiness and sadness, bouts of high-level panic and low-level anxiety. But rage was an emotion with which she was not familiar, so it took her a moment to identify the feeling whooshing through her veins. Was this girl really going to block her from entering her own childhood home? "Hi there," Simon leaned in front of Amy. "I'm Amy's boyfriend. Sorry to be a pain, but could I come in and use the bathroom? I'll be very quiet if everyone is asleep." He didn't really think he was her boyfriend just because they'd slept together twice, did he? She gave him a look. He winked. There was a beat. Of course, Savannah knew Amy was single. She knew everything about Amy's family, although they knew virtually nothing about her. Savannah tapped a fingertip against her lower lip, almost as if in parody of Joy, who did the same thing to indicate skepticism. If Savannah denied Amy's boyfriend this valid, ordinary request, she would kick down the door. Come in. Savannah opened the security chain with an upward flick of her finger, opened the door and stood back, as if she lived there, which technically she did, but temporarily, supposedly. There was just nothing guest-like in her behaviour. Steffi, the traitorous hound, sat at Savannah's feet as though she were Savannah's beloved pet and politely cocked her head at Amy like they were meeting for the first time. Once again, Amy registered how the house felt perceptibly but pleasantly different, as it had on Father's Day. It was like it had been styled by a clever real estate agent for inspection by potential buyers. There were flowers on the sideboard in a vase that Amy had never seen before. All the family photos on the wall were the same, but they'd been straightened or dusted or polished so that all those familiar shots of their childhood were suddenly thrown into sharp relief. Simon held out his hand to Savannah. "Hi there, I'm Simon Barrington," he said in a loud, showy voice completely unlike his own. "So pleased to meet you." She took his hand. "Hi, I'm Savannah." "Savannah." He kept holding her hand, waiting for her surname, like someone's embarrassing uncle. "The bathroom is this way," said Savannah. "I'll show him the bathroom," said Amy. And she knew she sounded 13. Then she said, "Well, but, you know, what actually is your last name, Savannah?" Because how are they going to secretly investigate her if they didn't even know her last name? Did their parents even know it? They may never have even asked and had probably never bothered to Google her, just blithely believing every word she had to say. "It's Pagonis," said Savannah. "Savannah Pagonis." The cut above her eye had completely healed, and she was wearing just a touch of makeup. And there was a kind of creamy, settled confidence to her, as if she were wearing her own clothes in her own home, and Amy and Simon were unwelcome guests who she would soon be sending on their way. Amy's mother's clothes didn't look wrong on her. They looked exactly right. She was a younger version of Joy. She could be Joy's daughter. Joy had probably dreamed of a pretty, feminine little daughter like this. Amy and Brooke had talked about this over the years, how their mother sometimes made them feel huge, like big, lolloping orangutans. "Oh, that's unusual. How do you spell that, Savannah?" asked Simon. It was like watching an accountant perform in an amateur community production. He was terrible, but so adorably committed. "Pagonis," answered Savannah, eyebrows arched. "Huh," said Simon. "Is that, let me guess, Greek?" "Apparently," said Savannah shortly. "Savannah Pagonis," repeated Simon. "I bet people never spell it correctly. I hope your middle name is something simple, like Anne? Marie?" Amy looked at him admiringly. His delivery remained forced and theatrical, but the strategy couldn't be faulted. "You guessed it. It's Marie," said Savannah. "Do you want me to spell that too?" Could he really have guessed it that fast? Or was Savannah just going along with it to shut him up?
It's my mother's name, said Simon. Marie is very popular as a middle name.
He opened his mouth to ask another question, and Amy took him by the arm. Next, he'd be asking for her date of birth and tax file number. If Savannah did have evil plans, Amy didn't want her feeling compelled to fast-track them.
The bathroom is this way, she said.
Wait, is this you?
Asked Simon in his natural voice. He'd stopped in front of a photo of Amy triumphantly holding up a tiny trophy with both hands, racket resting against her thigh, big Wimbledon-winning smile, even though it was just the under-9s regionals.
Yes, that's me, said Amy.
You were so cute, said Simon.
He kept standing there, examining the photo.
I didn't know you played tennis.
Yep, she said.
I play a bit of social tennis, said Simon. We should have a game sometime.
You'd probably beat me.
I would definitely beat you, said Amy. She pointed down the hallway. Second door on the left.
Simon looked at her blankly, forgetting his ruse to get inside.
Bathroom? Amy reminded him.
Ah, yes. Thank you, Amy.
He returned to his loud, overly enunciated tone. When he left, Amy and Savannah looked at each other. It was the oddest feeling. Amy was in the home where she grew up, with photos either side of her attesting to this, and yet she still felt like Savannah was the host. She couldn't seem to find the right balance between two indisputable facts. Savannah should feel grateful to Amy because her family had given her shelter in her time of need. Amy should feel grateful to Savannah because she was taking care of her parents and doing a better job than any of the Delaney children ever would or could.
I'll just pop my head in the door and see if Mum is still asleep, said Amy.
A complicated expression crossed Savannah's face.
Sure. I'll get back to the kitchen. I'm in the middle of making minestrone.
Sing out if Joy needs anything.
Sing out if Joy needs anything, because I am the one who can provide your mother with everything she needs.
Sing out was a Joy phrase. This girl was a mini Joy. The besotted dog pattered off on Savannah's heels. Amy resolutely turned her head the other way as she walked past her old bedroom where Savannah now slept.
Selfish, childish. No one else in the family still considers any room in this house their bedroom.
She heard the toilet flush as Simon completed his fake bathroom visit. She pushed open the door of her parents' bedroom. It smelled as it always had, a comforting mix of her mother's perfume, her father's deodorant, and the old-fashioned furniture polish still used by good old Barb and Amy's mother when they cleaned together. Her mother lay on her side, facing away from the door, the covers pulled right up over her shoulders. Her hair, which brought her so many compliments, was mussed against the pillow. Amy tiptoed to the end of the bed. Her mother was asleep, breathing steadily, one hand curled up near her lips so that she seemed to be kissing her knuckles. She had told her children this was because she had sucked her thumb as a child, and it still gave her comfort to have her band thumb close to her mouth. The lines on Joy's face looked like crevices. Amy breathed fast as that old familiar terror gripped her. All children feared their parents dying, except Amy had once been so consumed by her fear that she hyperventilated and had to breathe into a paper bag, and the babysitter had to call Joy and Stan to come home fast because this kid was weird. She wondered what would have happened if her mother had died when Amy was a child. How could the reality of grief be worse than her imagining of it when she had imagined it so very, very hard? How would she cope now when her parents inevitably did die, as parents inevitably did, and you had to be so grown up and mature about it? How did people cope with ordinary, predictable tragedy? It was impossible, insurmountable. Amy? Her mother opened her eyes and sat up. She put on her glasses from her bedside table, smoothed down her hair and smiled. Amy, you've caught me napping. It's good that you're napping, Mum. Amy breathed slowly in and out. Her mother wasn't going to die for decades. You've been in hospital. You should be resting. Joy waved her hand dismissively. I took my last antibiotic this morning. I'm fine now. I just get tired in the middle of the day. Come here. She patted the side of the bed. Give me a hug. Amy went and sat next to her, and her mother hugged her fiercely. You look especially beautiful today, darling. I wasn't so keen on the blue hair at first, but now I think it really makes your eyes pop. Thanks, Mum, although I guess they'd pop more if my eyes were blue. You should dye yours blue. Narelle is in charge of my hair, and I don't think she's keen on blue. Her mother stifled a yawn. Why are you here anyway? Where's Savannah? Where's your dad? Savannah before Dad. Savannah is making you soup and Dad is asleep in front of the television. He has this idea in his head that he never naps, said her mother. He just briefly closes his eyes. Will you please pass me my hairbrush? Amy got up and passed her the heavy silver embossed hairbrush that had always sat on her mother's dressing table since Amy was a child. Her mother had received it when she won a district tournament as a teenager, back when brush and comb sets were common prizes for female competitors, while the men got cigarette cases. Amy still coveted that brush. It looked like something a princess would use. You visited the hospital. You didn't need to come again. Her mother used swift movements to brush her hair back into its smooth white bob so that the frail old lady vanished to be replaced by Amy's trim senior citizen mother wearing a long-sleeved cherry-coloured jersey. She threw back the covers to reveal her vulnerable little legs in tracksuit pants. Have you seen Brooke? How do you think she's coping with this separation? I couldn't tell when she visited. Do you think Grant left her for another woman? No, said Amy, but I think he'll move on to someone new with lightning speed. Do you remember when Brooke was a little girl, said her mother, and every year she fell in love with a new boy in her class? I do, said Amy. She was very cute. Brooke used to write love letters to boys. It was hard to imagine now. I was just thinking about that, said Joy. For some reason, she used to be so passionate, and then it felt like growing up just flattened her. Those damned migraines. She frowned and put a hand to the side of her mouth and whispered, I feel like Grant kind of flattened her too. Amy put a hand to the side of her own mouth and whispered, Me too, Mum. We might get her back, whispered Joy. We might, whispered Amy. Joy's eyes danced and she spoke again at her normal volume. Anyway, thank you for coming. I know how busy you are, but you don't need to worry about me because I've got Savannah. Yes, you do. Said Amy, deflating. She's doing everything. I don't need to lift a finger. I'm treating her to a shopping day tomorrow to thank her.
A shopping day? Amy shuddered at the thought. That's nice of you.
It's not nice of me. It's the least I can do for her. Do you know, I can't remember the last time I cooked a meal.
She said this as if it was something to be marvelled over. Amy couldn't remember the last time she herself had cooked a meal either. Unless heating up leftover Uber Eats in the microwave counted. Brooke had mentioned that their mother was obsessed with the fact that she didn't have to cook anymore.
It's like she's had this secret loathing of cooking all these years, Brooke had said. Once Savannah moves out, we'll have to do something about getting her help.
She'd paused. If Savannah ever moves out.
How much longer do you think Savannah will be staying for? Amy asked her mother.
Oh, gosh, we're not even thinking about that right now. I need her, said her mother. For example, who would have cooked for your father when I was in hospital?
As if that, her father's dietary requirements, was the most significant thing about her hospital stay.
Amy said, well, I guess we would have. Or he could have got takeaway. Or he might even have cooked for himself.
Very funny, said Joy. Anyway, I'm sure she will want to be on her way soon. I don't want to take advantage of her. She's doing so much now that I feel like we should actually pay her some sort of a wage.
Like a live-in housekeeper, said Amy.
Imagine that, said her mother dreamily. The thing is, if you were employing a live-in housekeeper, you would get references. So I'm just thinking, well, obviously I'd never get a real live-in housekeeper, said Joy.
I'm just saying that we don't really know that much about Savannah, said Amy, and she lowered her voice and looked towards the door.
I actually know lots about her, said Joy. We've had some long chats while I've been recuperating, do you know? And I find this just so interesting, so fascinating.
Joy's face lit up.
Savannah has something called highly superior autobiographical memory. She ticked off each word on her fingers as she said it. She can remember whole days of her life with a degree of detail that you and I, ordinary people, would find impossible.
Really? Said Amy skeptically.
She bristled at the way she had been lumped into the category of ease, ordinary people. She herself felt she could remember events from her life in quite significant detail, thank you very much.
She's actually received a diagnosis of that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you get diagnosed with it. I don't think it's an illness as such, although she did say it's both a blessing and a curse, because while it's nice to remember the good events, she said she also remembers the bad ones. And as we know, she has not had a normal, happy life. Poor girl.
Huh, said Amy.
She took the hairbrush that her mother had left sitting on the bed in front of her and replaced it carefully on the dressing table. Then she went and quietly closed the door and sat back down again.
What is it?
Her mother sat up straight and propped a pillow behind her back.
What's happened? Has something bad happened?
Panic flooded her face. Damn it, I thought that new counsellor was helping. I thought you were good at the moment.
I'm fine, Mum, said Amy testily. Why did her mother always assume there must be some crisis or other in Amy's life?
She registered the irritated damn it that accompanied her mother's panic. Her mother would never shout, stop being so ridiculous, Amy, pull yourself together, like she had done when Amy was a kid. She now knew all the correct, supportive, modern things to say about mental health, But Amy knew that there was an unconscious part of her that still wondered if Amy did indeed need to just stop being so ridiculous and pull herself together. Amy was like a defective household appliance that would never be replaced, but that everyone knew could break down at the most inconvenient of times. So, what is it? Logan called me today. He saw a rerun of a documentary on television, and it was about domestic violence, and the girl on it told almost the exact same story that Savannah told him about her boyfriend. He said it was virtually word for word. Her mother knitted her brow, baffled. So, what are you saying? It just seems like too much of a coincidence, said Amy. But I still don't understand. Are you saying this girl on the television knows Savannah? What? No. I'm saying maybe Savannah saw that show herself and thought that would make a good story. And if she really does have this superior memory thing, I guess that's why she could remember it so well. There was no story, Amy, said Joy, coldly, furiously, totally unlike the helpless, sleeping old lady of moments ago, more like the mother of Amy's youth, who had had it up to here with you lot and was at the end of her tether. I bandaged up that injury myself. I'm not saying her injury wasn't real, but maybe the cause of the injury. You're accusing a woman of lying about domestic violence. Amy's mother's eyes were bright. That's outrageous. You're a feminist. Have you heard of the I Believe Her movement? Oh, God. She was simultaneously so with it and so naive. Amy said, Mom, it just seems like a really big coincidence. That poor girl is in my kitchen right now making my favourite soup, said Joy. Do you know how much effort goes into minestrone? How much chopping? It's extremely laborious. Let me tell you, Amy, I believe her. She was ready to march the streets, a placard held high. Somehow their positions had reversed. Amy was the middle-aged cynic, her mother the zealous, idealistic teenager. The bedroom door swung open and her father was there, holding a mug of something steaming. Hi, sweetheart, he said to Amy. Does the young bloke sitting in the kitchen belong to you? Chapter 29 Now. Did you ever meet the mother? Liz Barrington asked her younger brother as he sat at her kitchen table doing her tax return for her. Simon didn't look up from the pile of receipts. The missing mother, clarified Liz. He frowned at a faded receipt. I can't read this. Your flatmate's missing mother? Said Liz. Amy's missing mother. It was all thanks to Liz that Amy had moved into Simon's share house in the first place. Liz had been Amy's Uber driver. Now she had given up Uber driving because she had her own, much more fulfilling mobile spray tan business, Tan at Home with Liz. The night Liz picked up Amy, they got chatting and Amy convinced her to park the car and join her for a drink with her friends, which had been okay, but Amy's friends were so random. One of them was like 60 years old, literally 60 years old. And if Liz wanted to talk with 60-year-olds, she'd go visit her mother, thanks very much. That night, Amy mentioned that she needed somewhere new to live, and Liz told her that her brother's flatmate had just moved out. So that was how her brother and her Uber passenger ended up living together. Her name is Joy. I have met her, said Simon. I met the father, too. Liz was thrilled. So what do you think? Do you think he's guilty? Everyone seems to think the father did it. I don't know, said Simon. Have you got to know Amy very well?
asked Liz. She must be upset. Imagine if our mother went missing and everyone was accusing Dad. I mean, I can't even imagine it.
She reflected on this for a moment.
I could totally imagine the reverse. Mum would do a really good job cleaning up the evidence, wouldn't she? She's always deleting her search history, which is actually quite suspicious.
Simon said nothing.
How well do you know her, Amy?
I know her pretty well, said Simon. He squinted at the next receipt. Did you really think eyelash extensions were tax deductible?
Liz shrugged. I need eyelashes for my work.
No, you don't.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that.
He picked up the next receipt.
So you've, like, hung out with her?
Asked Liz.
He bent his head to her receipts again. Oh, my God, Simon, she said.
She felt a rush of love for her clueless little brother.
First his cow of a fiancé breaks his heart, then his weird older flatmate gets her claws into him.
You had to watch those cougar types who dressed like 20-somethings. Boys couldn't see the Botox. Although Liz was pretty sure Amy wouldn't have had Botox. She was too hippie and new age. But she definitely dressed and acted younger than her wrinkles.
Amy must be, what, 15 years older than you?
12 years older, he said. 12 years, 3 months and 24 days.
Chapter 30. Last October. I'll try the apple crumble, said Joy to the waitress at the David Jones cafeteria, where she sat opposite Savannah, surrounded by a triumphant array of stiff, shiny, string-handled shopping bags at their feet.
With ice cream or cream? Asked the waitress.
With both, said Joy firmly.
It was a family tradition to always try the apple crumble whenever it was on the menu, in the forlorn hope that they might one day find an apple crumble as good as the one Stan's mother used to bake. It was her signature dish, like Amy's brownies. Everyone apart from Joy got misty-eyed when they ate apple crumble and said, "Not as good as Grandma's," while Joy thought to herself, "Trust the old bag to never share her secret recipe." One day, someone would work out the missing single ingredient, and then she'd be properly dead.
"Please, may I have the apple crumble too?" said Savannah, in that funny, almost childlike, well-mannered way she had. "Also with cream and ice cream."
"Same as your mum, then."
The waitress flicked her notepad closed. It was the second time that day they'd been mistaken for mother and daughter as they'd shopped, trying on clothes in adjacent change rooms.
"Do you want to see what your daughter thinks?"
a shop assistant had said to Joy as she tried on a long-sleeved, floaty floral dress in a colour she would never normally wear. Savannah had convinced Joy to buy the dress.
"You look really beautiful," she'd said, eyes narrowed, "and it's 20% off. It looks well made."
She dropped to her knees on the floor beside Joy and folded back the hem of the dress to show her.
"Look at the stitching on the lining. That's real good quality."
That's real good quality. The phrase had snagged in Joy's consciousness. It sounded incongruous from a girl of Savannah's age, like something Ma from Little House on the Prairie would say. And yet it was one of those moments where Joy felt she was seeing the real Savannah, as if her interest in the dress made her forget herself for a moment, and a veil was lifted. Savannah was so ready to serve, like a hotel concierge, unfailingly courteous and warmly interested in your plans, that Joy sometimes had to remind herself not to bask in that interest, just like a self-absorbed hotel guest. It was an effort to make Savannah talk about herself, but she was chipping away at it. She'd noticed it helped if it was a bit later at night and just the two of them, especially if Joy suggested a nice little glass of brandy. That was when Savannah had told her about her highly superior autobiographical memory. They'd been talking about Joy's memoir writing class and how there were some periods of Joy's life that were just a blur. "I wish my memories would blur a bit," Savannah had said, looking into her glass. "I remember everything. The details never fade." Now Joy pushed aside the cutlery on the cafe table to lean forward, chin resting on her hands, to properly examine Savannah. She definitely looked better than when she'd arrived on her doorstep. Joy wished she could say it was because she'd done such a good job of looking after her, when in fact the opposite was true. Savannah had done such a good job looking after her. "Are you feeling tired?" Savannah asked her. "Not at all," said Joy, although she was a little. "Thank you for convincing me to get that dress." Savannah smiled. "I bet Stan will love it." "He'll love the discount," said Joy. "It's a good dress," said Savannah. Joy's mother would have appreciated Savannah getting on her knees to check the dress's lining. She used to do that sort of thing. Check the stitching of the seams, target the hems, sniff contemptuously if it wasn't to her liking. Joy had loved a long, lingering day of shopping with her mother. It had been hard when the children were little and their tennis was all-consuming. But once every year, she and her mother would have a day just like this. It was so satisfying, so pleasurable going from shop to shop, hunting out bargains, accessorizing an outfit, realizing that the blue in that new blouse was a perfect match for the blue in that skirt, and then sitting down for a break at a cafe like this to rest your aching feet and discuss what else you needed. Joy's daughters both hated shopping. Amy began to mutter about commercialism and bright lights and feeling like a rat trapped in a maze or some such nonsense, while Brooke was so task-focused, tapping her feet, her hand on the small of Joy's back, hurrying her along. "Chop, chop, Mum, a fast shop is a good shop." Brooke only ever shopped online.